This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Springtime in Central Florida and love bugs are everywhere. Any kind of road trip you take through the Sunshine State is usually accompanied by love bugs splattering on the windshield. So where do these love bugs come from and what are they doing here in Florida? How do they fit into the ecosystem? What's the best and worst way to try and get them off your car? We'd love to hear your love bug horror stories, comments and questions to 1-866-338-5252. And you can reach out to us on Twitter as well. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio is Denise DeBusk. She is a professor of horticulture at Valencia College West. Denise, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Norman Lepler. He is a professor of entomology and the program director of the University of Florida's Integrated Pest Management Program. Thank you so much as well, Norman.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Matt Mormon is a creator of the car care blog and YouTube channel Obsessed Garage, knows a few things about how to keep your car free of love bugs. Matt, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Good morning.
You can join the conversation as well. We're at 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts? What are you seeing? You reckon there are fewer love bugs these days than previous seasons, or are you seeing more of them? Like to hear your comments as well. You can reach out to us on Twitter too, at WMFE Orlando. Well, Norman, I want to start with you. What's the origin story for love bugs? Have they always been in Florida? Were they an introduced pest? Was there a reason for them to come here?
Well, they weren't introduced, and certainly not by the University of Florida. They came from Yucatan, apparently all by themselves, and arrived here in Florida about, late 1950s, early 60s, and then became outbreak.
Mm-hmm. And do folks know how they got here? Did they come in on some cargo, like a ship or something?
We have data showing in insect collections all the way across Texas and the Gulf states that they arrived in steps. So we think they did it without much help from people.
Mm-hmm. What kind of role do they have in the kind of food chain then? I mean, do they have any predators? I know there's some concerns, you know, when they hit your car, they can cause some damage. So presumably there's something inside them which maybe might make them not as pleasant to eat for a bird or some other kind of predator. But how do they fit into that food chain, if at all?
Well, there's a big word, aposematic, and that means that they look like they might be distasteful. And certainly they are to birds. That's been tested. But they have predators, I'm sure. They have pathogens. And on the side of being on a car, they aren't acidic. That's a myth that we've tested, and certainly they aren't acid.
Mm-hmm. What is it then that makes them bad for your car? Is there something in the kind of in the insides of a love bug that means they're going to damage the paintwork?
Well, what you see on the car primarily is the bodies and eggs. The granular material is eggs, and those are the ones that splatter. And it's something inside those insects. We don't know what it is, but other organisms that splatter on the car, other insects, will cause the same problem.
Mm-hmm. Have there been attempts in the past, Norman Lepler, to try and introduce something else to take care of the love bug, or have they never really risen to that level of problem?
Well, what you're referring to is biological control. And no, we haven't introduced anything to take care of love bugs, but we have for lots of other organisms, and we do safety testing to make sure that we can do that without harming anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about love bugs in Florida. It is love bug season. I want to hear from you as well. What are you seeing? Are there some certain areas that you avoid this time of year because you're worried about love bugs damaging the paintwork on your car? I was chatting to somebody the other day who said they were taking a road trip and decided to rent a car rather than actually taking their own because of their concern about love bugs. You can reach out to us at 1-866-338-5252. We're on Twitter as well, at WMFE Orlando. Well, Matt Mormon, if I could bring you into this conversation, is this kind of high season for you as far as taking care of people's vehicles because of the love bug problem?
Yeah, I tell you what, I'm from the Northeast. If I would have known about these things being a car guy, I certainly wouldn't have moved here.
Really?
Yeah. It's a big problem on your car. It becomes one of those things, like if you really want to care for your car properly, you need to wash it every 2-3 days and get them off the car. That's news to me that they aren't acidic. I guess it makes sense, but mm-hmm. There's something about love bugs that's maybe it's the splatter that seems to damage paint much more quickly than other bug issues. You know, obviously, Central Florida, we have lots of bugs, being a tropical-like climate, but for whatever reason, love bugs seem to damage paint. They damage paint protection films, or you know, what you would call clear bras, rather quickly.
Is there anything that people can do to try and prep their car ahead of love bug season? Do you offer anything like that? Like, is there some kind of spray coating you can put on your car to make it a bit easier to clean off?
You know, there's lots of rumors about how to care and how to take care of your paint and how to remove them. Most of those are not a good thing to do, like using dryer sheets. I've heard people spraying Pam on the surface of their paint. You want to avoid doing stuff like that. I even had one of my assistants back in several years ago, her son used a magic eraser to remove them, which was obviously not a good thing to do. The smartest thing to do, what I recommend people do, is, let's say, tax day, April 15th, wax, put a fresh coat of wax or sealant on your paint, which is a pain in the butt. You've got to wash it, clean it, prepare it, and wax it. But if you have some sort of sacrificial layer on the surface, when you wash the car, you know, the bugs will come off much more easily, and you won't have to introduce abrasive things to try to remove them.
Mm-hmm. So the wax is kind of like that sacrificial layer, so to speak.
Yeah, and now there are modern techniques or modern materials called resin-based coatings that are much more generally reserved for professional installation, but those are even harder and tend to reject things sticking chemical. Mm-hmm. They tend to have chemical resistance to allow you to remove things like bird droppings and bugs, in this example, a little easier.
Right.
But you don't want to get things, you don't want to get anything abrasive. I mean, a dryer sheet is a mild abrasive. If you do that, you're going to scratch the paint.
Huh. Well, good advice there from Matt Mormon. Some car detailing tips there on love bugs. Got a question coming in from Brian on Twitter. He writes, where do they all go? Well, I want to throw that question to you, Denise DeBusk. Where do they come from? Like, you know, how do they emerge, I guess? And what happens at the end of love bug season? Where do they vanish to?
So love bugs don't actually disappear so much. The adults actually only live for a few days, and then they oviposit in the soil because that's where the larvae live. That's where their babies live, is in the soil. So they oviposit a bunch of eggs into the soil.
Right.
So during the time when we don't actually see the love bugs, that's where they are. They're actually decaying matter, which can be helpful to the ecosystem with that decay. So they're living, they're growing. And during those times of the year when we actually see love bugs, during that kind of that April, May, and August, September, that's when the adults are emerging. And they're not all emerging at once. They're emerging slowly as the larvae pupate and then become adults.
Right. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm hearing that they're actually serving a purpose, like the decomposition or what have you. That's actually good for the dirt.
Yes, there's lots of different types of organisms that break down our soil. If we didn't have those, we would just be living in piles of organic matter. We probably couldn't even live here because it would just be so high that it would be impractical.
Mm-hmm. So you had to take a bit of a drive to get here, Denise, this morning. Did you bump into a lot of love bugs on the way?
Actually, I didn't. This isn't the high fly time for love bugs. That's more of the 10, 11, and then the 6 to 8 range at night. So I even heard yesterday... Who was I talking to? I was talking to my brother, and he was on the road, and he was like, oh, I think the love bugs have decreased. And I'm like, oh, well, they may be decreasing pretty soon. And then so he was on the way at around 8:30, he called me. And then on the way back around 11 o'clock, he's like, oh, my gosh, they came back.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, well, it's the high fly time.
Mm-hmm. Got some calls coming in. Doug, you're on the air from Apopka, I believe. What's your experience being with love bugs?
Yeah, I commute every day. In fact, I'm on my commute right now. I commute every day from Apopka to Rockledge over on the Space Coast, and I have to cross over the St. John's River.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they seem to be the worst, is on the 528 just as you get near the river. Mm-hmm. But they are really bad this year. I've gone through 4 bottles of windshield wiper fluid since Monday. And I come home every night and have to get my pressure washer out to pressure wash out all the bugs off my truck.
Wow. Okay. Are there roads you try and avoid? I guess you can't really avoid going over the St. John's.
I have to take that road to get over there. There's really no alternative. Either way, if I go on 50 or I go on 528, I still have to take the road that goes across the St. John's River that's no avoiding it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doug, good luck dealing with the love bugs. Thanks for calling in. And an interesting kind of comment there. I want to ask you about this, Norman. Do you kind of study some of the fluctuations in population? What are we seeing here long term? Are the numbers going up? Are they going down? Are they going to other states?
Well, they're up this year, obviously. We're getting more calls and more interest. And I do a census here in the parking lot at the university, and I can tell you there are more love bugs on the front of cars than there were last year. But it's interesting that the distribution is spotty. And what the person said who called in is very true. You'll go through an area, and Dr. DeBusk as well, you go through an area that is relatively clean or a time of day when it's clean, and then later you go through an area where it's heavy. It's just not uniform throughout any part of the state.
Hmm. And what about other states? Are they finding they're having to deal with this problem too now?
Yes, these insects are across the Gulf states and up to the Carolinas. I haven't heard any reports from other states, but I'm sure that they're having similar situations.
Mm-hmm. Got another call coming in now. We've got John calling in from Orlando. John, what's your experience of love bugs?
Oh, I found that love bugs, besides from just being a nuisance for your cars, they can also be quite annoying for if you're working outside.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if you're trying to do anything, either working or, you know, just trying to enjoy being outdoors, that they can just practically swarm you at times. And then I also found that cleaning them off, that dryer sheets work really well if you take and put them in the bucket, you know, of soap and water that you're using, so it kind of like mingles with the soap and water instead of just using the dryer sheets themselves.
Well, some interesting perspectives there, John. Good luck with dealing with your love bug infestation, and thanks for calling in. Let me throw that one to you, Matt Mormon. Soaking the dryer sheet, I sense that you probably think that's still not a great idea. What are your thoughts?
Well, a dryer sheet certainly will work well, and you know, sandpaper would too, you know, a Scotch guard, and all that stuff would take the bugs off easier. The issue is then you end up with scratched paint. I mean, if you were to go to Target, you know, and walk the parking lot, let's say you walked in between the cars and looked at hood after hood after hood, most cars are scratched and swirled, and that's from doing things like using dryer sheets or using improper wash techniques or going to a car wash. You know, car washes in general are some of the worst places to get your car cleaned.
You're talking about the ones where you drive through and that sort of buffs your car automatically?
Yeah. I mean, and you know, if you have a regular car that you don't really care much about, it's fine. I mean, clear coats are designed to be pretty durable. It just depends on how you want it to look,
mm-hmm.
you know. So if you're dealing with what I'm dealing with, and Porsches and BMWs and Ferraris and people that are really real enthusiasts about their car, you know, doing something, using something abrasive on the surface is not a good idea if you wanted to keep it looking nice for a long time.
Do your clients then, if they're driving Porsches, Ferraris, and the like, do they have love bug season cars? Like, do they just garage their Porsche during sort of this time of year and later in the year when the love bugs are out?
Some of them, but most people, you just have to resign. Like today, I got to go wash a couple of cars. You know, so every couple of days, you got to get it off. So that, you know, the worst thing you could do is drive it, park it in the sun, leave it there for a week and a half. That's when you'll find the bugs will etch, you know, the clear coat, and you can't remove it.
Right.
It'll usually go, like, they'll etch it really deeply. And the only way to remove it would be to remove paint, to sand it down and sand it pretty deeply. And there's only so much clear coat on the car.
Mm-hmm.
It's about your entire base coat, clear coat primer is about the thickness of a sheet of paper. And the only way to fix them would be to remove paint, and there's only so much there.
Right, so the bottom line is you can't leave that stuff on your car too long, and it's going to damage the paint.
Yeah, you want to get them off. So you are better off using dryer sheets than leaving them on there.
Hmm.
But in a perfect world, you'd just want to wash it with a much softer microfiber towel of some sort. It's harder. It's more work. You got to work harder to get them off if you're going to do it properly.
Right. Denise DeBusk, let me come back to a point that one of our callers was making, crossing the St. John's River and noticing sort of swarms there. Why is it that you see swarms in certain areas? Do they just like bodies of water, or is there some other reason for kind of bumping into clouds of them in one area versus another?
Likely in that area, there's going to be a lot of vegetation. And since they're emerging out of that vegetation, it's nice and moist. So the populations will have been able to survive a lot easier in those areas that have a high moisture. So in areas that might be around rivers or round lakes, you're going to have higher areas. Because I've noticed just by looking at the vegetation, there's a lot of love bugs just right there trying to go back and oviposit back into the soil.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any, like we were talking to Norman before, and you're saying that basically birds don't like eating them, but are there other critters within the insect world that might take a bite out of a love bug?
For the adult stage, likely no. But for the larval stage, there are different things like fungi and possibly other predators that may be eating them while they're still young in the soil.
Mm-hmm. Is there any thought to trying to get them under control, or is it more just a case of they're a bit of a nuisance and they're not really it's not like they're maybe kind of causing a problem for the agriculture industry or anything like that?
They're certainly not causing any problems when it comes to anything except being a nuisance. And when it comes to funding projects for research for finding things like biological control, the focus is going to be more on those more profitable types of commodities. Mm-hmm. And also things like us. If it's going to give us a disease like a mosquito, we're definitely going to focus on that more when it comes to control.
We're talking about love bugs. It is love bug season, one of the two seasons for love bugs in Florida. What's your experience been making your daily commute, or maybe even just getting out and about in your yard and seeing those love bugs swarm in? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can reach out to us on Twitter as well. We're at WMFE Orlando. Norman Lepler, I want to come back to you for a moment. Is there kind of a broader question here about what to do when you have like a nuisance bug or something that is causing problems within a certain industry? What's the best way to go about getting a handle on that? I mean, is it sometimes better just to live and let live and let these bugs do their thing if they're not causing too much of a problem?
Well, it really is, unless people are very sensitive to the nuisance pest. And some people are, and we recognize that. But most people should just learn to live with these things and sometimes appreciate them. The love bug, for example, the adults don't last more than a couple of weeks in any particular area. They come in May and September, so it kind of changes the seasons, and we get along with our lives and enjoy nature. So I think nuisance pests are very low on our list of priorities in terms of any kind of control. Mm-hmm. And also, people sometimes call pest control companies, and the companies are very good about telling them that really spraying is not going to help.
Right. What about that question that kind of came up at the top of the show? Because there is that myth circulating that love bugs were introduced to try and control another insect, and that didn't go so well, and a university has to blame. Like, do you get that question every single love bug season?
Oh, even between seasons, it's remarkable how rumors get started and persist. There's no way that a love bug would even be a candidate for a predator. It's not a predator. It's a plant feeder. Mm-hmm. And predators have big mandibles or teeth, and they have big claws. And you know, something like a dragonfly would be a candidate for a predator. But love bugs don't even fly at night, so the whole idea is just completely out of the question.
And dragonflies hunt at night? Is that what happens?
Dragonflies are also diurnal, but they're quite effective predators on the kinds of prey that people talk about love bugs being designed to protect us from.
Mm-hmm. Got another call coming in here from Neil in Winter Park. Neil, what's on your mind?
Hi, my name is Neil Weeder, and years ago I was taught by a trucker that if you use a combination of baking soda, Dawn liquid, and water, and use a very gentle, soft rubbing surface to clean it off with, and the love bugs just come right off. And the reason was, chemically, baking soda is a basic chemical, and it just neutralizes whatever the pH is of the love bug. And I found it to be very effective for years, and it didn't hurt the surface of the car. The only thing that was a little pain in the neck is because the baking soda has like a little residue.
Uh-huh.
You just have to re-rinse the car. But I'd be very curious, and I'll take it off the answer offline, is what the person has found the pH of the love bug to be. But thanks very much for listening.
Thanks for your call, Neil. Appreciate that. Two responses possible here. I want to go to you first, Denise. What about that pH in the love bug? Okay, I see you shaking your head. Norman, what can you tell us about the pH of the love bug? Is there any merit in the fact that you can kind of neutralize it with something basic like baking soda?
I've been collecting love bugs and checking pH, and then I check scrape them off of cars and check the pH and let them sit and everything I can think of, and I have not been able to get them much over neutral.
Hmm.
But so there are enzymes in these organisms that can be really damaging, and I suspect that the eggs are the culprit, but I don't have the research data to prove that.
Right, and it doesn't sound like there's really too much of an incentive to really dig into it and figure that out if they're not like damaging the agricultural industry. Matt Mormon, baking soda and Dawn soap, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that'll certainly work. Anytime you use a soap that's alkaline, so a basic, on a pH of 8, 9, 10, 11, that would be a stripping soap. Like Dawn is basic in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So we would use Dawn to strip off waxes, sealants. The only problem with using Dawn is, like you'd mentioned, or baking soda, you end up with a residue that you have to then remove. I actually have a soap that I use that's a pH of 10 that we would use to strip the waxes and sealants prior to polishing. So the only issue with doing something like that, yes, it will certainly help remove and break down the bugs, but it would also break down whatever your sacrificial layer was.
Huh.
So my preferred way to do it is to put a quality sacrificial layer, a wax or a sealant, and then what you'll find is the bugs will generally wipe right off as long as you don't leave them on there for a week and a half or two.
Got it.
And if you use a basic soap like that, you'll end up stripping that sacrificial layer, and you may not want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is this? Do you find yourself sort of run off your feet at this time of year, Matt, dealing with people and their love bug problems?
Well, I'm eating because I'm a YouTube guy. I don't actually wash other people's cars. I only wash my own and teach people how to do it. So I'm just peachy. Other than having to wash, I have four cars, so I have to wash them all the time. But other than that, it is frustrating to any car person. But definitely anybody that has a detailing business is working overtime this time of year.
Mm-hmm. One more question coming in from a listener. Love bugs, best way of getting rid of them, the experience is glass cleaner, foamy Windex, saturate the bugs, and then wipe them off. Matt, thoughts on that? Is Windex a good thing to be spraying on the surface of your car besides the windows?
No. The issue with using glass cleaner is it doesn't lubricate very well.
Mm-hmm.
It won't scratch, but it doesn't add any lubrication. So the best way to do it, wash the car with a pH-neutral soap. Of course, wax first, wash it with pH-neutral soap with a soft towel,
mm-hmm.
and then afterwards, after you've dried the car and gotten the sand and dirt and dust off, any remnants that are left over, that's where you could use something like a detail spray and a soft towel to remove the rest of it.
Well, Matt Mormon is the creator of the car care blog and YouTube channel Obsessed Garage. Thank you so much for joining us, Matt.
Sure.
We're also joined by Denise DeBusk. She's a professor of horticulture at Valencia College West. Thank you so much, Denise.
No problem.
And Norman Lepler is an entomology professor and program director at the University of Florida's Integrated Pest Management Program. Thank you so much, Norman.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Up next on Intersection, we're talking creativity with Orlando architects Maurizio Massa and Trevor Boyle. Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Holocaust Memorial Resource and Education Center of Florida is auctioning off 76 artworks created by artists and community leaders in Central Florida. Each of the artists were given a pair of figures dubbed Hope and Humanity and given free rein to put their creative spin on them. Some of the pieces were created by architects from Hunt and Brady. That's the firm that's designing the Holocaust Center's new museum in downtown Orlando.
Hi, I'm Trevor Boyle from Hunt and Brady Architects.
Maurizio Masso, Hunt and Brady Architects.
So tell me about the brief you got from the Holocaust Center. What did they ask you to do?
Okay, it's a really exciting idea. They are asking artists and, in our case, architects and other folks to come up with creative table centerpieces for their upcoming dinner gala. And the theme is hope and humanity. So in our case, we received four patterns of the models that they asked different people to use. And so we came up with, you know, four different ideas.
So, Trevor, tell me about how you approach this. You basically have a template. You can do whatever you want with it.
Yeah, it's a blank canvas that everybody got, the exact same pattern of these two figures reaching out and holding hands. When I saw it, I was kind of really inspired by that idea of people coming together, holding each other up. And I thought about the idea of the righteous among the nation. It's this list of people who were the rescuers in the Holocaust. And it ties into that idea of hope and humanity, that even in these really dark times, there's this light that kind of shines through the darkness and like sort of illuminates that idea there's still something good in everybody.
That's a pretty lofty idea. How do you convey that in a physical 3D form?
Well, you buy some LEDs off of Amazon, and when they show up, you just kind of start messing around with it. I came with the idea of kind of this transparent veil, so it was simply just going to Home Depot, going to a bunch of places, trying to find something that can kind of let this light in and look how to obscure it, but he can still kind of read what's underneath.
Maurizio, how unusual is it for you to get an opportunity to just kind of do something purely creative and not have to worry about things like, is the roof going to leak or are these windows going to fit or things like that?
Well, it's a very freeing experience because we don't have to worry about those things that you mentioned. So, no, we got really excited. 99% of the time we design buildings and interiors. Occasionally, we're asked to do these special projects. For example, a few years ago, we were asked to do a sculpture for Adventist University. We came up with the idea of there were 6 feet by 14 foot high color glass slabs that depicted miracles of healing miracles of Jesus. And they occupy the center of their campus here in Orlando. A while back, we were asked to enter a competition for a pet house, and we came up with a very architecturally cutting-edge house for a small pet. The creative process is basically the same, but used in different ways. So we really enjoy that. And in this case, the mission of the Holocaust Center and the hope and humanity theme is one that is very dear to our hearts. We're designing the museum for the center, and so that kind of ties in with what we're doing. And some of the ideas that we're going to be seeing in these centerpieces could be inspirational for our design of the building.
I want to ask about the pet house. What kind of animal was it?
It could have been for a dog or a small dog or a cat. And it was very deconstructivist. It had, it was on casters, and it was kind of low. It had a sliding door, very faceted. If you're familiar with architecture, it had a little bit of a Zaha Hadid look. Very out there, and it sold at auction. So it was all for a good cause. Actually, it was for the museum, the Science Museum benefit.
So some lucky pet is living in this architecturally designed marvel right now. Does that pet realize how lucky it is?
We hope so. I'm not sure that a pet ever occupied the dwelling, but we hope it's a It's a pet that appreciates good architecture.
Hopefully the roof isn't leaking on that pet house.
Trevor, do you, you an artist on the side as well?
Dabble. It comes with the territory a little bit. My brother was always an artist, so I kind of grew up following him a bit there. And so that's actually went into architecture because it is a little bit of that, that art, but mixed in with a little bit of engineering. So you can kind of, it's something you can physically touch at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Is it frustrating sometimes though, trying to marry the vision you have for a building and the kind of engineering realities, or trying to make sure things fit into a budget?
Definitely, but it's also the fun part of the challenge. That's actually the really cool part about it, is solving that problem. A project, an idea without any kind of limitations at all is extremely boring, because you can do anything. It's limitless. By adding limits to it, you can buy either money or, oh, this thing might fall over, you know, and how do I make it not do that? It actually adds, it eliminates some of those possibilities and brings you closer to what actually works. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, art is something you might have to go to an art gallery to see, but architecture is among us all the time. So it's kind of like art you have no choice but to experience in some way or another.
Oh, and it's, yeah, at the end of the day, all that time, those hours, it's something you touch. You know, that's the best thing about it, is finally at the end of it, after all the heartache and after all the complaints about, yeah, this thing is now, you know, too expensive in making this work, and oh, your idea gets chopped down. No matter what, you can go there, you can touch it, and it's a physical thing.
So, Mauricio, can you tell me a little bit more about the design for the museum itself? Like, what's that going to look like when it's done?
We're working on it. We're at the stage where there's a group of designers, exhibit designers, and ourselves, and the folks from the Holocaust Center. We're developing the program, what we call the program, which is a space allocation for the center, and also the storyline. What is going to be exhibited? How is it going to be displayed? How is the story going to be told? It's not going to be just about the Holocaust. It's going to be much broader vision. It's going to talk about human rights and bullying and current issues that are relevant. So once that storyline is developed and the program is finalized, then we'll start finalizing our conceptual design. And from there, we'll go into what we call construction documents and you know, the final deliverable for design.
Do you think the kind of approach to designing museums and other public buildings has changed a little bit in the last few decades, like the building itself can be a work of art?
Well, architecture is ever changing, and there are trends. As far as museums, historically you've had museums that are about the architecture, about themselves, the Guggenheim being one of them. Sometimes those museums are not the best environments to show art. Some of them are more background buildings. So what we're trying to achieve for the Holocaust Museum is sort of a balance between, a place that is flexible and conducive to display what needs to be the story that needs to be told, as well as an iconic building that people will recognize and become, you know, part of the fabric of the city.
Does the entire firm have a part in this project? Like, are you going to be involved in helping design this as well?
Yes, I've been on since the first iteration back in 2016. We have different sort of sectors throughout the firm, so there'll be small teams throughout it. We're a fairly large local firm with about 90 people, so odds are everybody's probably not going to have a hand in it. But at the end of the day, it's a Hunt and Brady project, so everyone will still have some pride in it, hopefully.
Just back to the sculpture design that you all took part in, it sounds, Mauricio, like you're going to be looking at some of those other centerpieces and saying, we could take some ideas from this and maybe incorporate it into the thinking for the museum design down the track.
Yeah, absolutely. We're very curious to see what they all look like, and I'm sure the messages, as well as maybe the execution of the centerpieces, could give us hints and ideas for for our design.
That was Mauricio Masso and Trevor Boyle of Hunton Brady Architects talking about the centerpieces they designed for the Holocaust Memorial Resource and Education Center of Florida and their design for the new Holocaust Memorial Museum in downtown Orlando. Up next, the Bluegrass Revival, a conversation with Amy Robbins and Galen Amundsen. Rocked my world for me. Then I said somehow, some way, it'll all work out sometime, someday. Somehow, some way, it'll all work out sometime, someday. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Joining us in the studio are Amy Robbins of the band Maple Sparrow and Galen Amundsen. Amy on guitar and vocals and Galen banjo, vocals and fiddle. Here they are now with a song called The Worries. When I was a younger girl, I didn't believe them. The world was at our fingertips. Yeah, I thought we were beating. You took me to outer space, showed me the enemy rings, promised me the galaxy, said I'd be your everything. You stayed so sad, while the weight of the world was a feather on my back. Time after time, dwelling on the troubles in your mind, you never see the worries that are mine. If I was a smarter girl, maybe I'd leave, go and study medicine, cure some bad diseases, move to the ocean side, live with the changing tides. No vows are left to keep, still hate to admit defeat. You stayed so sad, while the weight of the world was a feather on my back. Time after time, dwelling on troubles in your mind, you never see the worries that are mine.
Hi, I'm Amy Robbins.
I'm Galen Amundsen.
Maple Sparrow is my project. It kind of started as a stage name and turned into a band or whatever other entity I play under for it.
Where does the name come from?
It's actually kind of funny. When my husband and I moved into our house in Howie in the Hills, Florida, which was a family home for him, his grandmother had left some things around the house, and I was cleaning out one of the closets, and this little wooden bird fell out. And I said, oh, it's a maple sparrow. Look how cute that is. And we looked at each other. I was like, that's a stage name. And it kind of just stuck from there.
So what's the bluegrass scene like here in Orlando, Central Florida. Galen?
It's good. I learned old time here and then went kind of to DeLand area for some bluegrass when I was little. It's good because there's a jam at Orlando Brewing, and my first fiddle teacher inspiration is in town. And now I'm teaching Amy some old time guitar. So it's making it much easier to stay in town when you have people that want to play the bluegrass and stuff.
Did you start out as a bluegrass musician, Amy?
No, I like bluegrass. I've always listened to bluegrass and been to a couple jams and stuff, but I would never have called myself a bluegrass player. Kind of got started on like old country type of stuff and learned a bunch of like 90s pop covers and stuff like that to play in bars to get me started. And I started writing music, and I like to think it's kind of a, I call it Americana, kind of bluegrass, country, blues, fusion type of thing I do.
What about yourself, Galen? Do you have some country roots as well?
I guess I mostly have music roots. My grandma was a piano teacher. My mom is a painter. And I just got a fiddle when I was little and went from there. And we traveled around quite a bit. So I got out of Florida, I guess, in 2009 and started going to other festivals and realized there was just this whole new world of music. And now I try to take it back here. And happily, it's just being so accepted this year. So I'm happy to like carry on that bluegrass torch in Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Is there a continuum of musicians who've been playing bluegrass for decades?
Definitely.
Or is there a revival where people are just discovering it for the first time?
Oh, in our town here? I would say first timers. I haven't found so much of like the tradition that, because I do miss that when I'm here. I miss the tradition and the family legacies that are in Virginia or whatnot. But it's still all there for us, and now we're starting our own legacy.
Amy Robbins, do you have some other instruments up your sleeve as well?
I play bass some also. Started on the mountain dulcimer.
Me too.
Is that something you lay on your lap to play?
Yes, it's a lap instrument. It's got four strings. One of them's a double string.
Oh,
the high string.
Fancy.
Yeah. You can play it with a slide or you can chord it. And it's pretty basic, easy to learn on.
We do. I used to go to the jams out in Longwood at the library on dulcimer jams. Like
starting. Do they still have them?
I don't think so.
So, well, that's just a bunch of musicians all with dulcimers?
Yes, a very big library room full.
They make a lot of noise, a dulcimer?
It's pretty loud, yeah.
Together they make quite a rumble, but they sound good together.
Yeah.
It's all in D, mostly, the key of D.
Yeah.
And there's books, tab books. I still have mine.
Amy, I probably do, too.
We could start a dulcimer jam.
We should.
Well, Amy Robbins and Galen Amundson, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks
for
having us.
This is a song called Boy Blue. 1, 2, 3, 4. It'll all work out sometimes.
That was Amy Robbins and Galen Amundsen with a track called Boy Blue. They performed on Intersection back in September last year. And to take us out, a track called Someone Like You.
Clusters of leaves block the sky in green. The sun shines through. A sea of swords blanket the ground, end up from the brush quail flew. Nails and ports stretch on for miles, follow it but don't fall through. Well, under the woods the little crocodiles, just waiting for someone like you. Waiting for someone like you.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne, technical direction from Juan Gualda. Production assistance for today's show from Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. We're almost at the end of our spring silent drive. Your support during this drive will help keep 90.7 WMFE strong throughout the summer. Your contributions allow us to bring you Intersection, Spotlight, the Are We There Yet Space Exploration podcast, and our award-winning reporting from the 90.7 News team. If you've already made a contribution, thank you so much. If not, there's still time to become a sustaining member and help us make our drive goal. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go online to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
Waiting for someone like you. Looking for someone like you. They'll flash in their best sharp toothy grin. I'm right here, baby. I can teach you to swim. I've been waiting for someone like you. Tonight, the horizon's painted pastels. I throw my blanket along the earth. I rest my head and I soon pass out. I dreamt of mountains covered in shrubs. I walked hard, but I had no shoes. A lioness and her baby cubs, and we've been waiting for someone like you. Waiting for someone like you.